I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
All right, now let's get to those minutes from that last Fed meeting, which was, of course, March 20th. We want to head over to Bloomberg News international economics and policy correspondent Michael McKee. Mike is live in Washington, D.C. at the Federal Reserve. Mike.
Well, recent data, including today's CPI reports, have eclipsed the value of the minutes in terms of monetary policy. They show, as expected, great concern and uncertainty among officials about the path of inflation, the outlook for the labor market, and growth. Participants generally noted their uncertainty about the persistence of high inflation, the minutes say, and expressed the view that recent data did not increase their confidence that inflation was moving sustainably down to 2%. And of course, today's CPI reading will contribute to that. There was even some disagreement about rate cuts this year. Almost all participants judged that it would be appropriate to move policy to a less restrictive stance at some point this year. Almost all is Fed speak for all but one or two, so at least a couple of people disagreed. The news in the minutes actually comes from the committee's discussion of the balance sheet. The staff presented a number of scenarios for reducing the $6.9 trillion level of holdings. The participants generally favored reducing the monthly pace of Treasury holdings runoff by roughly half of the $60 billion a month current cap. Because mortgage bond runoff runs well below the $35 billion monthly cap, the participants saw no need to trim that. The participants judged it would be prudent to begin slowing the pace of runoff fairly soon because there was great concern about repeating the experience of 2019 when runoff went too far, disrupting money markets. A few participants indicated they preferred to continue with the current pace of balance sheet runoff until market indicators begin to show signs that reserves are approaching an ample level. Now, no decisions were made, but it does sound a little bit like we might see the Fed start to trim its reserve holdings and slow QT before we even get rate cuts.
So, Mike, we're going to give you a moment just to think about all those headlines, but just real quickly, let's update everybody on the market. You've got the S&P 500 still down about 51 points, so just shy of 1% here. The NASDAQ 100, a decline of 176 points, so it, too, is shy of a 1% decline, but definitely off some of the earlier levels that we saw today. And you still have, what, a 10-year, Tim, that's at 452, and looking at the shorter end of the yield curve, most sensitive often to what the Fed might do, and you're looking at a two-year note with a yield of 4.93.
That's right. That two-year yield up 19.7 basis points, and the 10-year yield up 16.8 basis points as we speak. Hey, Mike McKee, I want to talk a little bit about the data that we've gotten since the latest Fed meeting, the hotter-than-expected jobs report, the hotter-than-expected CPI report. In your mind, does that change at all what these members of the Federal Reserve see as the path to cut rates moving forward?
Well, it's a good question. We can look back 3 weeks and see what they saw then, and there was great uncertainty then, but they were leaning in the direction of still being able to cut rates this year and still thinking that disinflation would continue. Those lines are in the minutes. But now that may not be the case. They were looking then at January and February numbers that suggested to them that there might have been some seasonality problems. There might have been some problems with the way the data were put together. But today you have a third CPI reading that suggests that no, there is a stickiness to inflation that they hadn't counted on. We won't get a complete read at the May 1st meeting because they don't put out a new summary of economic projections and they don't do a new dot plot. But I'm fairly certain that between now and then, and of course between now and the June meeting, we will hear a lot from them about the possibility of holding back.
All right, Mike, as you stated, and as we went through those headlines, those FOMC meeting minutes from that March 19th, 20th meeting, I'm just looking to you at our right through, if you will, showed almost all officials judging it would be appropriate to begin lowering borrowing costs at some point this year. However, again, that caveat, inflation data since then has upended expectations for three interest rate cuts this year. Could those expectations in terms of rate cuts continue to be upended if the data continues to come in strong, particularly the inflation data?
Oh, certainly. I mean, we've seen that in the markets today now. Mm-hmm. We at least when we went into the minutes lockup, the betting was that there would be no rate cuts until November. So we're starting to see this pushed out. And of course, before the Fed began its meetings, we'd heard a number of people say that, or since they began, we've heard a number of members say that they might think we would do fewer rate cuts. Of course, Rafael Bostic saying that he was in favor of only one. Neil Kashkari saying there is a possibility they wouldn't do any. So the markets are now going to be perhaps positioned for the idea of few or no rate cuts this year going forward.
Hey, we're certainly seeing something like that play out in the rates market. The front end of the yield curve, 2-year higher by 20 basis points right now, the 10-year higher by 17 basis points. I want to bring in Ira Jersey, who's standing by in our Bloomberg Intelligence headquarters in Princeton, New Jersey. He's chief interest rate strategist here at Bloomberg Intelligence. Ira, when you see yields shoot up like this across the curve, what's the signal that it's sending you about the path of interest rate policy for the remainder of the year?
Well, it's up because of the path of interest rate policy, right? So when you look at the when you look at the short term interest rate markets, you know, we've been pricing out more and more of those six or seven 25 basis point interest rate cuts that were priced in a couple of months ago. And when you keep on getting this relatively strong data, it's hard to kind of get in front of that and you know, think that the Federal Reserve is going to be able to cut rates. You know, there's a whole group of investors who are concerned that the Federal Reserve may actually have to increase interest rates. You've heard that from some former policy officials as well. I personally am not in the camp that thinks that they necessarily have to increase interest rates in order to slow the economy. But the idea, because, and one of the reasons is that first you have to get rid of all these cuts that are being priced into the market. And in doing that, you're effectively tightening monetary policy because the, you know, longer term interest rates are now higher than they were just a couple of weeks ago. So, yeah, you know, there's a lot of data and information that came out today, and
right,
including a pretty bad, actually the worst 10-year auction that we've had in about 2 years. You know, that was a pretty astounding, revelation that demand just isn't very strong.
Is that because investors assume that it's going to go even higher in terms of the rate outlook?
I think that's part of it. I think it was also, you know, obviously you had, Carol, you had the really, you know, good inflation number this morning, high inflation number this morning, which was bad for the market and keyed off the sell-off. I think also, you know, it was an hour before we got the minutes that, you know, I still am only about a quarter of the way finished reading. So we have, so it's hard to get in front of some of that news cycle. There was also a lot more market risk today. So yesterday's 3-year auction was okay, but today's 10-year was absolutely abysmal. Tomorrow we have 30-year bonds. It'll be really interesting to see if people say, oh, look at these higher yields at, you know, 4.6%, 4.7%, wherever we end up at auction time tomorrow. Is that going to draw in some buyers just thinking, hey, I want to get these yields while I can? Or are they going to stay away because they are worried that, hey, inflation is going to remain kind of at these reasonably high levels and the Fed's going to be on hold so I can get even better returns later if I just wait a little bit?
Well, one of the former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers saying that the hot U.S. consumer price inflation report for March means that the risk case of the next Fed move is to move to be an increase must be taken seriously. He also talked about the idea of a rate cut. Here's what he said earlier on Bloomberg.
A rate cut in June, it seems to me, would be a dangerous and egregious error comparable to the errors the Fed was making in the summer of 2021 when it just didn't get the thread on inflation.
Mike, I want to bring you in. One last question from you. Would it be a dangerous and egregious error if the Fed did any kind of rate cut in June based on what you're seeing?
Well, dangerous and egregious might be a little strong words for it, but I don't think the Fed is going to be rushing into anything like that. Remember, what we're seeing is the markets move and commentators talking about what the markets are doing. They're not talking about what the Fed's doing because the Fed hasn't done anything. July 2023 was the last time they moved interest rates. And while we've had speeches about what they may or may not do, they haven't done anything. I did want to point out one thing that might be important if you still have Ira there, and that is that they did have this discussion about the balance sheet and the idea of trimming, starting to run off their balance sheet run down to about half, $30 billion a month instead of $60 billion a month caps, and leaving mortgages at 35 because nobody is really prepaying at this point.
Ira, you want to come in on that?
Yeah, that's almost 100% of my concentration right now, looking at the minutes, because it hasn't aged very well, right? We've gotten a lot of information and data since that March meeting. So it's really, how are they going to adjust the balance sheet? Basically, they've said that they're going to slow down the amount of treasuries that they're going to allow to run off. That's in line with what we were expecting, and I think that was more or less the consensus. There was some nuance around that, but that was broadly the consensus. When they're going to start is still a little bit unclear, but it's probably going to be sooner rather than later. And the reason for this is that if bank reserves are starting to run off more quickly now that we've seemed to have found a floor for the reverse repo facility, and as reserves run off, at some point they're going to be scarce, and demand for bank reserves is going to be much higher than are out there. And that's what causes a lot of volatility like we had in September of 2019. The Fed wants to avoid that, or at least be able to turn off the spigot very quickly and stop the runoff more quickly. And they don't want to go cold turkey from 60 billion treasuries a month to zero. So they'll go from 30 to zero probably.
Ira, we have one more question for you. Mike, we know you've got to run, but we always appreciate all that you do for us in breaking this all down. Our Mike McKee there at the Federal Reserve in Washington. Ira, one more for you. I'm thinking, we've got a really smart, sophisticated audience here at Bloomberg. There are, though, folks who are like, well, wait a minute, are we getting into kind of the weeds when we talk about the balance sheet? What's the significance when the Fed comes out and says, or that we got revealed in these minutes, that the runoff, they're going to start to slow it down? What's the significance of that?
Yeah, I think that there's an acknowledgement that the financial plumbing matters, and it's not something that prior to 2007 anybody really cared about, but it's really what makes the world go round. So when you think about the repurchase agreement market, which is the market that helps fund treasury dealer desks and hedge funds and other traders in treasury securities, if that breaks, then the entire financial sector can just break down. And what underlies that, kind of the grease that allows the wheels to continue turning within the short-term funding markets, ends up being bank reserves. So when bank reserves get down to a level that is less than what's demanded by banks, then banks suddenly have to find reserves from elsewhere, and that's what causes interest rates to spike and for the financial plumbing to start to seize up a little bit. Again, you saw that to some degree in 2019. Now the Fed's done some things to try to mitigate that, like creating the standing repurchase agreement facility that allows banks, whenever they need it, to inject reserves into the system, as opposed to the Fed deciding when to do that. But this financial plumbing stuff, you cannot completely discount it. It's actually way more important than I think most people who get their MBA or just study business in school or finance. They don't teach this stuff, and this is actually the stuff that really, really matters to the overall market structure and functioning of markets.
It's why we love having you here. All right, Ira Jersey, thank you, of our Bloomberg Intelligence team, and our thank once again to Mike McKee out there in Washington. Guys, thank you.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern.
Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app.
Or watch us live on YouTube.
The private markets we know, private equity, private credit, they're one of the hot topics of investing, especially among the institutional set. Bloomberg News reporting just last week how a trio of academics has a bold take on the booming $1.7 trillion private credit market. And that is, after accounting for additional risks and fees, the asset class delivers virtually no extra return to investors. So really curious, Carol, what our next guest has to say about that.
All right. We welcome in Hartley Rogers. He's executive co-chairman at Hamilton Lane, a private markets investment management firm with $903 billion in assets under management and supervision. Hartley is joining us from our Bloomberg News Bureau in Toronto. Hartley, great to have you here on Bloomberg Business Week. Like most folks in your world, we like to start macro. When you look at the global environment, where do you see the strengths? Where do you see the risks?
You know, Carol and Tim, first of all, thanks for having me on. I think we're pretty bullish in a way about private markets right now. I think the data and stats show continued outperformance in all of the private market segments, including private credit, Tim. And we feel pretty good about how things look. We feel like the risks of significant interest rate rises are low, and therefore there's more predictability as you look out at the world. It may be, especially given today's inflation print, that rates will be a little higher for longer. It may be that we'll see some softening in the U.S. economy towards the end of the year. But we're pretty constructive about the opportunity set, especially in the buyout space. The buyout part of the private markets has been the kind of stalwart, strong part of the markets for decades, and it continues to be that today.
Why aren't you concerned about rates going up significantly, given the data that we got today?
Especially as everybody seems to be pairing bets that, you know, the Fed is going to do cuts. Traders also pairing ECB rate cuts after today's CPI print. So it just feels like the narrative has changed.
I think that higher for longer certainly is part of the narrative today. But remember, if you look back at the private markets have been around for a long time. And if you go back 20, 25 years, we were operating in rate environment very similar to the rates that we're in today, and private markets did just fine. And so I'm not a macroeconomist, but I think, as I said, our house view is that the chance of rates going up is very low. They may just stay where they are for a little bit longer, but we don't see that as a significant headwind in private markets.
Interesting. I mean, what indication to you out there? I know, again, you're not macro, but you have to think about this macro stuff when you're making investments, when you're raising money. What is your outlook for the remainder of the year? What is your outlook when it comes to not just the U.S. economy, but the global economy?
Well, I think we feel like there's a chance of a soft landing. I think the U.S. consumer has been very strong. U.S. corporate profitability has been very strong. U.S. productivity is very strong. And so our view is that the U.S. remains a robust economy, but potentially with a bit of a downdraft towards a soft landing. I think globally speaking, there's plenty of opportunity out there. Remember, I come at this from a private market standpoint. I'm not really a public markets broad-based person. Private markets are a growing and important part, but they are far from the largest part of the global capital markets. And we specialize, our industry specializes in finding opportunities to invest in attractive growing companies and in places where you can make operating improvements, as the industry has always done for years, through our unique ability to control and influence and align the portfolio companies that we own.
Well, and we get it. And Hartley, you know that what goes on in the public markets that can impact to the upside or to the downside what goes on in the private market. So having said that, based on your outlook, where are the opportunities when it comes to, like, who's reaching out to you in terms of the private credit and who needs to tap the private credit markets increasingly?
Well, the private credit markets have become a replacement over time for the bank markets as you come in after the GFC, and they've done very, very well. They allow for a different style of investing, both from the investor standpoint and from the investee company standpoint. Many of our buyout funds that we invest in, and we're, you know, you know this, but we're one of the very largest investors in private equity funds in the world.
Right.
Many of the buyout funds that we invest in tap the private credit markets and are happy to do it because they feel that they're dealing with people that they can have a relationship with, that they can negotiate with. It's a more concentrated group of owners of private credit than when you have a more broadly based financing. And I think they feel that that can be very constructive as you're moving a company through its private equity ownership phase. On the investing side, there's a premium for private credit. There has been for a very long time, and there continues to be in our data. And to remind you, we have a very large data set in this area. So we do not agree with what Tim cited those professors are saying in terms of returns not being there in private credit.
Well, that's what I wanted to do. And I understand there's just so much information maybe you can share or want to share. But what kinds of returns are you seeing on average when it comes to private credit? And what is the right metric to compare private credit investments against, right? You buy a stock, you're either going to, you know, measure it against the S&P, you're going to measure it against a mid cap or a small cap. Like, there's so many different ways that are more apples to apples. But in, as you know, in private credit or in private equity, right, there's a lot of investments that certainly fill those buckets. So what is the kind of returns that you are seeing, and how do you measure it? What's the right metric or benchmark?
So very, that's a great question, Carol. And very broad brush, we measure private credit against two things. One is the leverage loan index, and the second is the high yield market index. Because most of what we do is in situations involving some leverage, right? Leverage buyouts, or buildings that are leveraged, or infrastructure investments that are leveraged, things like that. And so we try to look, depending on what we're looking at specifically, we'll find a finer tuned index if we need it. But broadly speaking, we look at private credit against those two things that I mentioned. And I would say in today's environment, obviously you've got interest rates that have gone up considerably. And so you've got to have a premium to those. So depending on what you're looking at, senior secured or not secured, you're looking at anything from high single digits to low double digits, kind of all-in yield.
Hey, Hartley, how do you grow private markets, at least for you, beyond institutional investors right now? I mean, do you think that these type of products should be available in 401ks, for example, in retirement products?
We absolutely do. These are investments that have benefited sophisticated institutional investors for decades. And there are reasons why some of the best known institutional investors have earned wonderful returns is because they have had significant allocations to illiquid investment, private market type investments. We see no reason why those should not be made available to the broader public, and particularly through the private wealth type channels. The critical thing to do is make sure you are educating the consumer and educating their advisors to understand how these investments works, how these investments work, and how you think about portfolio construction and exposures to them. But no reason why they shouldn't be broadly available.
Hey, Hartley, we're running up against the clock. 10 seconds left. You're in Canada because Hamilton Lane is expanding its presence in Canada. Why are you so bullish on Canada right now?
Well, Canada is a great market. It's very sophisticated financially. They have some of the strongest financial institutions in the world in terms of their investment reach and scope. So that's very important for us to be in dialogue with these people and to work with them.
Right.
Plus, Canada represents a tremendous opportunity for investment in things like infrastructure.
So appreciate it. Thank you so much. Hartley Rogers, Executive Co-Chair over at Hamilton Lane in our Toronto Bureau. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, Delta shares bouncing around today. They were up as high as more than 4%, now down 3.2% after the company says it expects earnings to exceed Wall Street's projections for the second quarter. This as Delta benefits from a step up in corporate travel and steady leisure demand heading into summer. We got Mary Schlangenstein, Bloomberg News U.S. Airlines reporter, joining us right now from our Dallas bureau. And Mary, I got to tell you, Carol and I were talking. We're looking at the chart throughout the day. We're wondering why.
Quite a swing.
Shares were up 4%. And then now they're down 3%. What's going on here?
Right. So initially, investors really favored their earnings report. And not only did Delta shares go up, but they pulled up some of the other airlines as well. But then when the Fed comments came out, about, you know, the rest of the year. And there was some federal data that showed that March airfares fell 7%. And so we think that's what's driving down the shares this afternoon.
Yeah, it's interesting. U.S. inflation data released did show airfares dropping about 7.1% in March from the prior year. Biggest decrease since November.
I will say that was Carol's guess. That was I will give Carol full credit. That was your guess.
Well, just reading through on all of you guys who are reporting. But it is interesting. Mary, you follow this sector. So more broadly, though, strong report from Delta?
Yeah, and what Delta talked about primarily was, one, that their operations, their flight operations, have really improved this year. And they're not alone in doing that. There hasn't been a lot of bad weather, and a lot of the airlines are performing better operationally. But they're also talking about a big factor being the return of some of the corporate travel accounts that were lagging, the areas that were lagging, like tech and financial services. They're finally seeing those companies come back. So that managed corporate travel revenue is back to 2019 levels. Wow. Volumes are still lagging, but the revenue has returned to 2019.
Remind us, Mary, about where Delta gets its revenue mix in terms of domestic versus international here.
Yeah, they're still more heavily domestic, but the differentiator for Delta is so much of their revenue comes from premium products. So in the first quarter, their premium product revenue rose 10%, main cabin only rose 4%, and that's been a pretty consistent thing for them. They really focus on that premium customer, and their sales, you know, have been leaning more toward that area for some time.
But since they're more heavily domestic, how much were they affected by a slowdown in potential slowdown in domestic travel and an increase of late in international travel?
So international travel has been really strong since last year, and Delta's saying it continues to be really strong. Even across the Atlantic, where there were concerns early on that there was too much capacity in that market this year, but Delta says there's plenty of demand. They see demand strong to the Pacific and Latin America. Domestically, they're saying demand's picked up too. They're picking up some travel, they think, from the domestic focus carriers that are having to rejuggle their schedules and redo their operating schedule because of some conditions specific to the domestic market.
You're talking about Boeing or Spirit JetBlue?
We're talking about Spirit, Frontier, okay. Allegiant. They're shifting some of their capacity.
Excuse me.
Yeah, out of
I meant
markets.
United. Sorry.
No, not United, okay. or Boeing. No, we're talking about the domestic focus carriers like Spirit, Allegiant. Even JetBlue to some extent.
Okay.
Hey, Mary, one thing I wanted to ask you, the CEO, Ed Bastian, saying in your story that you noted is that while revenue acceleration has brought the carrier back fully to 2019 levels, you just said that earlier, volume remains 85 to 90% of pre-pandemic levels. Does that mean, so yay, Delta has more of a runway to kind of grow that and grow the revenue line? Or is it, how is the industry rethinking about the levels that were pre-pandemic and where we are? Do we go back to those levels at some point?
Yeah. Well, on business travel in particular, I think that they believe that there's some segment of that volume that's just not going to come back because they're still seeing, a permanency to some of the changed travel patterns where people are taking, you know, to blend leisure travel and business travel. So their business trip may be longer. They maybe aren't traveling as frequently as they did before. So I think part of the volume is always going to be gone. I think the revenue, even on non-business travel, has exceeded 2019 levels already, and so has the volume for leisure travel.
Mary, my head is on the equipment providers, Airbus, Boeing, Embraer, Bombardier, all of which provide aircraft to Delta. I'm wondering, since it does have a mixed fleet, was there any commentary about Boeing on the call?
Not a lot. You know, Delta does primarily fly Boeing aircraft. They don't currently fly the MAX. They have the MAX 10 on order, but they don't expect to receive that for about 3 years yet. But what CEO Ed Bastian did say was that, you know, safety is a top priority across the industry, and that every day, you know, that's the top priority for every airline. So he didn't comment specifically on Boeing, and he didn't comment specifically on the safety incidents that have been occurring across the industry recently, but just said that's a top priority. He did say in an interview I had with him yesterday that he knows the new chairman at Boeing is familiar with him, and he expects that at some point he will talk to him about any concerns about Boeing itself.
Has there been any chatter about them changing their order of those new MAX planes that have not yet been delivered to Airbus, if that isn't even a possibility, given the Airbus supply constraints?
They just placed that order recently. They haven't had it for very long. And I don't think there's any consideration at this point. The deliveries are due farther out. That gives plenty of time for the MAX 10 to be certified before their deliveries come up, and even for Delta, for Boeing to catch up on some production. So I don't think that's being considered right now.
Yeah, I'm looking at, I just got to say, the overall industry, as you said, S&P 500 Super Composite Airlines Index, which was up 1.7% at its highs earlier today, it's now down about 3.5%. So we're seeing pressure, as you said, from some of that commentary about airfares. Having said this, Mary, what does Delta maybe tell us? Not every airline we know, it's not apples to apples, but what does it say about some of the other ones that will report throughout the earnings season, if anything?
You know, Delta is the only major U.S. carrier that is expected to report a profit this quarter. So there are other factors affecting American. You know, United, Southwest has its own issues. But Delta is the only one that's expected to report a profit. The others will have losses this quarter, and we'll see what their outlooks are going into the second quarter and maybe even the, you know, later in the year.
Really fascinating. All right, Mary, always appreciate it and your insight. Thank you so much for joining us. Mary Schlangenstein, once again, she's our Bloomberg News U.S. Airlines reporter joining us from Dallas.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just about 18 minutes left in today's trading session, getting ready to wrap up the Wednesday trade. This what's been another busy day, no doubt about it, but we did get a higher than expected forecast, if you will, hot inflation print. That was this morning. Then we got Fed minutes. Again, the rethink, Tim, in terms of what happens when it comes to the Fed cutting rates. Probably.
Why don't these analysts just
not much this year?
Why don't these analysts just raise their expectations?
About what?
About what's going to happen when it comes to inflation. Like, why don't they increase? Like, okay.
You're looking at metrics
it came in hotter
leading
than
up
expected.
To it. Yeah.
Well, you got to expect it that it's going to be hot.
Let's ask our next guest about what it means when it comes to forecasting. Penny Pennington is in the house. She's CEO over at Edward Jones, joining us here in our Interactive Broker studio. It is interesting. Forecasting, not a perfect science. You guys have to deal with it, too, in terms of what you think is going to happen with the markets. What do you feel like you can kind of securely hang your hats on when it comes to the investment environment this year?
Well, what you can securely hang your hat on is that we don't have a crystal ball. And so, as one financial advisor I talked to this morning said, a good plan is better than a poor prediction. And so our financial advisors work with 8 million clients. We engage with 500,000 North Americans every week. So you're right to ask, what is the pulse of North America around what our clients are thinking?
What are they thinking? Well, I love that. So you and I both love that perspective.
Inflation is not exactly how they come at it. They come at it with questions like, how am I going to be able to afford health care in a long life when health care inflation has been going up for a long, long time? And Matt, the financial advisor I was talking to today, Matt, what I bought at the grocery store 3 years ago that cost $100 now costs $130. Is that in our plan? Well, absolutely, it's in the plan. So what we talk with our clients about before we talk to them about what's going on in the stock market or what's going on in inflation, we say, what's important to you? What are you trying to accomplish, and over what period of time, and how much risk do you want to take doing that? And our clients are multidimensional people and families. They've got lots of goals, short, medium, and long term. And so when we have a day like today, or a year like we've had, or the last 5 years like we've had, we work with our clients on their financial plan and we flex it. We say, what would happen if we saw a longer term downturn in the equity markets? What would that do to your investment plan? And more importantly, what would that do to your life and financial plan?
You know, I'm hearing you say this, and it's interesting because you said that they're not coming at it with inflation being high. They're coming at it through the lens of, okay, well, we know the cost of medical care is going up. We know the cost of food is going up. That is inflation.
Exactly. That's right. They talk about it in terms of what it costs to live the life that I want to live.
And that's, I think, the way that it manifests for a lot of people, apart from gas prices, which are certainly volatile. I'm interested, Penny, in terms of like the commonalities that run across your clients. I mean, 8 million people around the United States who you work with. It's really runs the gamut, I know. But what's the commonality there?
The commonality is that our clients care about their health, their family, mm-hmm. their purpose, like their reason for being on the planet, and how that manifests in their financial plan. So strangely enough, what our clients want to talk with our financial advisors before we get to which stock or bond is, I'm concerned about how long I'm going to live mm-hmm. and planning for that. I'm also concerned about the next two generations of my family. And by the way, there's an $84 trillion wealth transfer that's in motion right now. Mm-hmm. And so family and how you pass on your legacy and your assets to your family. And then your purpose. Like, you know, what do I want to do in retirement? Is retirement going to be different for me than it was for my parents? It certainly is going to be different for my 30-year-olds than it will be for me. And so this is the common thread, the very real multidimensional ways that our clients express themselves. And the other thing that's common is that we want to get to know them.
Penny,
Every single one of them is different.
I think about someone like you who, you know, it's a very important seat in terms of a financial firm. And when you talk about generational wealth and that transfer, okay, that's great in terms of a CEO who runs a business that's based on people having money to invest or wanting to invest, that, you know, do you get more nervous about, I don't know, is it two generations from now that doesn't have, we talk about this all the time. I think about my dad or maybe, you know, your dad, you know, pension, investments, Social Security, several things, mm-hmm. you know, bought a house in cash outright 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. Like it was a very different dynamic. And I have younger individuals in my life, nieces and nephews, and they're like, I'm never going to buy a house. I just can't do it. These are well-educated people who are making a decent living. But I mean, how do you guys think about what is the lifeblood of your business going forward? And I don't know, is it two or three generations that maybe it's a little bit different business?
Well, we've worked with seven generations of clients in 102 years. And
that's backwards.
That's backwards. But I have no doubt that each generation looked to the future generations and said, how are they going to do it? It's getting more complicated. That's why it's so important to get good financial advice. We start with financial literacy. We're teaching a million learners in North America over these 5 years about the basics of saving and investing and budgeting and credit card debt. And then we invite those investors, we invite new—
Are they younger?
Absolutely, they're younger.
Okay.
They're in high school. And then we work with investors across the generations. We work with those who have money now and who are beginning the process of establishing wealth. It's not going to be easy, but it has always been the case. You know, the time value of money and compounding of interest is a magical thing.
Right.
People who understand that earlier in their lives and get on that train, that's what we help our clients
do. Yeah, I mean, unfortunately,
do.
they don't teach that in junior high.
No. Well, interestingly,
you have to learn it from your parents.
There are now 25 states that mandate financial literacy education in the high schools.
Really?
And we've been in 5,000 high schools.
Yeah.
We've taught 300,000 students just in the past 3 or 4 years.
I wonder if it's working.
what we have learned from those students is that their confidence is 53% higher, and they're over 60% more likely to start the process of investing. It's not magical to them at that point. It's become far less abstract, and it's become something that they could imagine would be part of their lives.
Do you think we'll need to get to a point, and forgive me, I know we're kind of getting existential a little bit, or bigger macro, we've got about 30, 40 seconds left here, but we get to a point where you're born in the government or something is put aside for people just because we don't have the retirement plans like that companies used to do in terms of pensions and so on and so forth. I understand 401k, but that's a little bit more active on an individual's part. Do we get to a point where there's government involvement, just quickly?
To solve this problem, there's a really important partnership that needs to happen between employers, between financial advisor and wealth management firms like ours, and public policy.
So appreciate it. I know we were going to talk a lot more Fed and stuff, but this was, I think, really smart because I just think about kind of what the future is in terms of the investment world.
Thank you so much.
Really appreciate it. Penny Pennington, she's the Chief Executive Officer of Edward Jones. She sees a lot. So does her team, joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.